2013, 2005.
Senator Moss Anderson.
Oh, Senator, where is that?
She's in the third row.
Oh, okay. Welcome again. We're going to open a work session, Senate Bill 879A. And
Senator Moss,
you've had a hearing on it, so you can do a work session.
Senator Anderson, you'd like to anything to add on this one?
No.
Okay, that's fine then. We heard the Senate Bill 879 last public hearing and a work session, and the bill was with us. Let me see what we have. This is exactly the same bill Senate passed out and with the mandate majority. And then I was going to put it in an amendment, but I'm not going to do that. The reason why, since time is the essence, and if we do that, this bill might not be able to survive. So I'm willing to pass out the Senate Bill 879A as it is. So do we have a motion to pass this bill? Yes, Representative Nelson.
Yes, I move Senate Bill 879A to where?
To the floor.
To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes. And the Representative Nelson moves the Senate Bill 879A and goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? There's none. Let the call the roll.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Gallen.
Aye.
Representative Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Chair Lynn.
Aye. And the Senate Bill 879A engrossed the passed. And is there a volunteer to carry this bill?
I would like to.
Like to, okay, Representative Nelson will carry the bill. Thank you very much. All right. I'd like to close the public work session on House Bill 879, and then we will move on to the. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2174.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2174 is the Oregon Economic Community Development Department's effort to rewrite the Special Public Works Fund. They briefly introduced the bill last time, and you have had the dash 3. We now have the dash 4, which has a few changes from the dash 3 that they will explain. I have information on the dash 3, so I'm going to read that. It replaces the measure. It restructures statutes authorizing and directing use of the Special Public Works Fund. It clarifies the distinction between development and planning project types. And it broadens the definition of emergency project to include critical municipally owned water and wastewater systems, transportation communication facilities. It deletes reference to key industries. It clarifies the intent of the fund is to be a revolving loan fund. It adds airports as eligible applicants, and it adds navigation improvement and land banking as eligible projects.
All right. Yes, please. I forgot your name. I'm sorry.
Gary Whitney.
Yes, thank you. All right, and could you explain what this dash 4 does, and just to give us a brief description? What's the differences from the dash 4 and dash 3?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd be happy to do that. For the record, my name is Gary Whitney. I'm the Infrastructure and Policy Program Coordinator for the Capital Projects Division of the Economic and Community Development Department. We made some slight editorial changes, and they start on page 7. There was a definition that was inadvertently dropped. It's line 4, rural area. So that was added back in.
Yay. Good.
Page 10, line 3, actually line 2, we added a colon. Line 3, we put in an A. Line 7, we reworded that slightly to make it more clear that there's some state funds being used as a match for the federal administration funds for the Community Development Block Grant Program. And line 10, we reworded that to make it more clear that it's administrative cost of the department that can be covered from the fund. The last change was page 20. Line 17. Used to refer to the Oregon Public Porch Association, which is no longer in existence. And instead we put in Oregon Ports Representation Group, which is a group that exists in statute. It by definition, includes all the ports in the state. That's all the changes.
Just some of the technical changes.
Yes.
Okay, and do we have any questions concerning this dash 4 amendment?
Mr. Chair, one question.
Yes.
Representative Vice Chair Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, tell us why the term key industries was removed? Mr. Chair, which I just looked up the definition for a week ago.
Representative Boone.
Is carrying that forward, and they could speak more at length about it, but the general consensus is the traded sector is the term that's more accurate because we want to be bringing jobs, new money into the state, and so we want to have support for the companies that are selling goods and services outside of the state or outside of the country. So it really emphasizes the traded sector and the new money approach to the job creation.
Thank you. And Vice Chair Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure where this is in the dash 4. It's in the dash 3. It's on page 11. And there's a series of guidelines that are deleted, including resulting in net benefit to the state, to not require continuing subsidies to support development businesses owned by women and minority groups, so on and so forth. Are these items restated elsewhere? These have been permanently dropped, and if they've been permanently dropped, could you give us insight to the department's thinking?
Mr. Chair, please. Could you repeat the last part of your question? I didn't hear it clearly.
Yes. Have these been permanently dropped from the bill, or these restated simply moved to another section somewhere?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berkeley, yes, they are being removed in the sense that the literal language is being taken out, and we did that to better combine the infrastructure and the community facility type projects under a single umbrella. But the spirit and the intent of these words is carried, particularly in the legislative findings section, which I believe is section 3. Remains largely unchanged other than some terminology. The legislature has always made it clear that this is a job creation and economic development program first and foremost. And by adding the community facility portion 6 years ago, they made it also clear that the program should be able to provide low-cost financing for almost any type of municipally-owned infrastructure that municipalities are forced to work with. So we wanted to be able to, one, focus on the job creation and the economic development portion of the program more in a more focused and concentrated way, while also expediting their access to low-cost financing. If their project is almost all loan or all loan, then it's really not the department. We don't really feel like we should be doing a lot of hand-holding and oversight, and so we wanted to expedite that process. It's not that we want to not do these, because we do. I mean, this is really the backbone of the program, and it's carried through, I think, in the legislative findings section.
Any other questions? Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Having grilled Mr. Whitney considerably yesterday, mm-hmm. I feel much better about understanding this huge package. But I just want to be sure I understand this, kind of based on what Representative Merkley was talking about. It's my understanding that this bill provides for funding for municipalities. And there is this 60% goes to rural and 40% to urban projects. And but these are all, are these all projects in municipalities that are owned by either the city, the county, or the special district?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, to answer the last question first, that is correct. These are facilities that are owned by cities, counties, special districts, ports, tribal councils or governments. The committee has before them a list of project awards from Special Public Works and Water Wastewater for the past several years. And the front is a summary, but if you start paging back and look at the title of these projects, you can see the city name or the county name of the county or the special district name, and you'll see that these really are sponsored by the municipalities.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I had concern over how we determine who gets these monies, you know, the process, and I see here you've provided us with a funding dollars that shows how much is spent. Do we have any current projects that are uncollectible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, not to my knowledge, we do not have any. I don't
that
believe
is.
The department has declared a loan in default in the 6 years I've been there.
So
but I could check up and make sure that we don't have any projects that are uncollectible.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So since this program began in 1985, I believe. So we have run this pretty lean and mean and have been very careful about the types of projects for which we loan or give grants, I'm assuming, because how else could you have such a good record in this area?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, that's
true.
So
you have a very strategic program when it comes to evaluating a project that's brought to you?
Representative Chair. Chairwoman, Representative Nelson, that's true. We have an extensive application process. I think the stakeholders might say it's too extensive and that we need to pare it down to just the more essentials, but we do have a rigorous review, both from the programmatic and eligibility side as well as from the financial side, with experts on both sides looking at it. And to follow up on our conversation yesterday, the committee has a map in front of them. The section that Representative Nelson referred to is I believe section 14, and requires that not less than 60% of the grants go to distressed or rural areas, and this is the department's calculation of distressed areas, and there's a map on the back, and you can see that the distressed area designation largely coincides with the rural areas of the state. Grants to that most needy communities.
And just one last question. Please.
One last question.
In talking about this, I see these counties that have not accessed this program, you know, like Harney and Grant and Malheur. They have, they're just, this does not include all those that have projects, just those that are determined distressed.
Yes.
Because of the economy.
That's true. That's correct.
Sure hate for, you know, Wasco County not to be in here.
Thank you. Save me a question, Representative Nelson.
All right.
Mike, you know, my concern, Chair Lim, on 2 days ago was I was really upset because it seems like for those of us who live in the rural areas, we have to fight and fight and fight for dollars. And I was concerned that specifically the large cities were named in this project. And what Mr. Whitney explained to me was it doesn't matter. At the end of every biennium, those larger cities cannot have more than 40% of this money.
That's correct.
And 60% stays mm-hmm. with the rural.
Yeah.
So that was my worry. I need to see all the money going to the metro, you know.
It is not. So
I feel better.
Good. And I'm glad to hear that. All right. And any other questions to Gary? Okay. I had extended discussion yesterday with Gary, and we went through major issues, and I'm comfortable with the bill. And thank you very much, and please stand by. I'd like to call at this time to make sure that this bill is okay. Linda Ludwig? Yes. Linda, could you come give us your view on this 2140-74-4.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Linda Ludwig for the League of Oregon Cities. Yes, we have been working with the department through the beginning of the bill, HB 2174, have reviewed the changes to the dash 2s, the dash 3s, and now the dash 4s, and are very much in support of the dash 4 amendments to the bill. We view this as simply a streamlining bill, basically a housekeeping bill to make the Special Public Work Water Wastewater Fund easier to use, and very much support the department in their efforts to do that. Although it may not be very specifically relevant to the bill itself, I just passed you out an email from the city of Lebanon that talks about their usage of the public works, the special public works fund, and how it was absolutely the only foothold they had for infrastructure funding for the Lowe's regional distribution center that will create between 600 and 700 family wage jobs in their community. That would have been absolutely impossible without the loan program and the Special Public Works Fund. And we continue to ask this committee and the rest of the House for support for this bill.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. If not, thank you very much. And I want to make sure, Doris, could you give us your version?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell from the Association of Oregon Counties. As with the cities and the ports organization and special districts, we work with the department on this bill. I think this is really a major effort that the department went through to try to make the Special Public Works Fund and Water Wastewater and those funds, the way they're defined in the statute, really easier to understand when you look at the statute. So I think this bill will be a real important thing for cities all over the state and counties all over the state. Every session there's a bill that sort of modernizes how we use these very critical programs. They really are the basis of support for economic development in Oregon. You can't just do job creation without some underlying support to communities, and that's what this is all about. So we're very supportive of this bill and these programs.
Thank you. Any questions? No, thank you.
Good, thank you.
Okay. Lastly, but not least, Ken, could you give us your vision from representing the ports?
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon,
Mr. Chair. Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Ports Group. We're supportive of 2174. Just as a clarification to make sure the committee's comfortable with it, the change that you see later in the bill relative to the Oregon Public Ports Association, the reason for that is that organization changed its name to the Oregon Ports Group. So the entity still exists, but it is under a different name, and all ports meet under the construct of the Economic Development Department with an Oregon Ports Representation Group, and so we're very comfortable with that change. We feel that it's better to talk about a representation group than to have a specific corporate name in statute. So that's the reason for that change, and we're comfortable with the changes in the bill, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions? All right. Thank you. All right. If there's no more discussion, and I would ready to adopt the Dash 4 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2174.
Moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendment to the House Bill 2174. Is there any objection? If not, then it's adopted. That's not in there, right?
Right.
Let me see. Okay, and there is also a Dash 1 amendment. That looks like can you explain what the Dash 1 amendment does?
The Dash 1 merely adds two non-voting ex officio members to the commission. There's currently the Oregon's Economic Community Development Department is directed by a commission. It's a five-member commission. There are no legislators on that commission. They also within the department is the International Trade Commission, and there are legislators on that. This would add legislators to the main commission, the five-member Economic Community Development Commission.
Okay. Now, who should I ask in the comment? From the Ken, maybe?
You might ask Dora.
This is a kind of poor. Mike, could you come up and give us your thought on this addition?
Sure.
Okay, Mike. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. For the record, Mike Salzgiver, Legislative Affairs Manager, Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. With respect to the Dash 1s, I have consulted the director and the governor's office. We have no position on the amendment. However, as you note, there are legislators on our International Trade Commission, and the department has found their presence to be very welcome and constructive. And if the committee's choice is to move ahead with this amendment, I'm certain we would have no objection.
Okay. How many do we have now? Five members of the port commissions?
We have, Mr. Chairman, we have five members on the Economic Development Commission. That's correct.
This is the full commission.
Mr. Chairman, this does not have to do with the ports. This has to do with the five-member Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission.
Oh, this is the full commission.
This is the commission that is appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate.
Yes. Okay. Yes, Vice Chair Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, how often does this commission meet, and what is their basic charge?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, the commission meets roughly every 4 to 6 weeks, depending on business. The specific charge is to guide the strategic plan for the department, and it also makes final recommendation and funding allocation decisions from various funds that the department administers.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
Oh, thank you. So it truly does serve as a board of directors then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, that is correct.
And Representative Dallin.
Yes, Mike, the origin, do you know the origin of the amendment to include House and Senate representation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dallin, I do not. I don't know the origin.
Thank you. Yes. Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Mike, this is a little off subject, But relative to this, does this commission track the number of jobs that are produced by these projects? And is there an accountability somewhere on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, yes, we do, and we do report that data to the commission. We'd be happy to provide that for you.
Thank you.
No, I'm to go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, as to the origin of the amendment, it is a committee amendment. It arose out of the discussion between the committee chair and the committee staff.
All right. And then do you believe that out of five members, the presence of two members from the legislature, it is too much overwhelming, or that the balancing out of the line, or what is your suggestion for that?
Mr. Chairman, I think ex officio members would not overload that commission in any stretch. A five-member commission is really a very good number to work with, and two legislators, one from each chamber. As I've said, with the International Trade Commission experience, we found that to be positive and constructive.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. And Gloria, could you give us your version also on this matter?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Doris Penwell from the Association of Oregon Counties. I've worked with the department a lot of years, and over time, and representing the counties, I think it's very constructive to have legislators involved very closely with the department and their economic development programs. We really believe legislators are sort of the economic development folks in Oregon anyway. So if they are involved, it's very helpful. The legislature used to have a very strong joint trade and economic development committee that met all in the interim and during the session, and experience from those legislators was very helpful to the workings of the department and to continue to modernize the programs and keep them on track. So the Association of Oregon Counties definitely supports any kind of involvement that legislators can have with the department.
Okay.
The
thank you very much.
Thank you.
And since these two members from the legislators, they are not voting members, ex-official non-voting members, so that the presence might be helpful. They can talk whatever they talk, but they don't have any voting power. So, all right. And any other person like to make a comment on this -1 amendment, right? Hearing none, and then do we have a motion to adopt the -1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 2174.
And the Vice Chair Bruin moves to adopt the -1 amendment to the House Bill 2174. There are no objection? Adopted. Okay, the bill is on us to move to raise votes to the floor. Or
I think it goes right to the floor.
Yes. Right to the floor?
Yes.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I should say that we do have a fiscal on the -3, which said no fiscal impact.
No fiscal impact. All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would move House Bill 2174 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Bruin moves to move House Bill 2174 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Any discussions? If not, call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Excused, but he might vote later when he joins us.
Representative Gallum.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Chair Lynn.
Aye. The House Bill 2174 amendment has been passed. And then do we have a volunteer on this one?
I'd be happy to.
All right. Vice Chair Bruin will carry this important bill. And with that, we are going to close a work session on House Bill 2174.
Sure, please. Come on. Is this here?
Yeah.
217.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And do we have all the copies? Okay. I'd like to open our work session. 3307. House Bill 3307.
Mr. Chair, this is the Jobs Plus program. It started out to be a simple elimination of a requirement that jobs made available Jobs Plus program participants not displace regular employees. That was your dash one. The dash two amendment was an effort to include the reauthorization and extension of Jobs Plus through the year 2012. The dash two included the dash one. What we have distributed here is an attempt to implement, this is the dash three, attempt to implement what you were talking about at the end, towards the end of the hearing that we had on this last time, which is a interim study along with the continued authorization to spend remaining monies in the fund. That's my recollection of what it does, but like you, it's just been handed to me, so I'm not sure it does what we thought it was going to do.
Okay, before we move on that, I'd like to give a chance to Vice Chair Mokley to vote on the Senate Bill 879, and then do I need to open a work session again?
He voted on 879. You want to open House Bill 2174.
Okay, I'd like to open a work session, House Bill 2174 first.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the permission to vote on 2174.
All right, any objection? If not,
you want to find out how he votes.
Oh, okay.
I vote aye.
Okay, vote aye. All right, and then it should be recorded that way, and I'd like to close work session of House Bill 2174, and I'd like to open work session of Senate Bill 8798. How do you vote on this?
You already voted on that one.
You already voted?
Yes, sir.
Oh, you already did.
But
okay.
I always love the opportunity to vote twice, though.
Okay, forget that. Okay, I'd like to open a work session again, House Bill 3307. And
why don't you give us about 2 minutes to look through this, and then I can summarize what's in here, and then we can
Okay. Move. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that any of our proponents of the various versions of this bill would be happy with this, so I don't know if there's anyone who would willingly come and describe what the dash three does. So your staff.
I would be happy to.
Representative Nelson would like to do that.
When you do that, you are going to get a step salary.
I get a what?
Step salary.
Step salary?
Step salary.
Step salary. Oh, good. I get part of Dr. Stembridge's monthly $10,000.
I have my shoes.
And it's not your new Nike shoes. All right.
Well, I don't want to take that job away from the Jim, so why don't Jim do that anyway?
Mr. Chairman.
You can add on later.
Mr. Chairman, if you look at the dash three amendments, which I believe we have available. Yes, they're out there. The Section 1 authorizes the Employment Department to use unobligated monies in Jobs Plus for the payment of wages. So this is the part that continues the program. You'll see on line 10, it's targeted at severely distressed areas designated by the Economic Community Development Department. By coincidence, I think you were just given a map of those areas in the previous bill. Okay. Section 2 creates the task force, and these task forces tend to have pretty standard language. Starting on line 15, you'll see the President of the Senate shall appoint one member from the Senate. We have one member from the House. Governor shall appoint six members. And you see the designation on those Chairperson of the State Workforce Investment Board, Employment Department Advisory Council, Jobs Plus Advisory Board, Education Workforce Policy Advisor,
and then one individual who represents business, one individual labor. The task force shall study the use of unemployment insurance funds to fund job training programs, including the Jobs Plus program, and then also employer workforce training program. The other language is pretty standard. The Employment Department and the Department of Community Colleges on Workforce Development provide the staff. That's down on page on lines 23 and 25. And then standard language on compensation for members. The instruction on page 3, line 3, that's pretty standard in these things, that all agencies are instructed to cooperate in the study. And you have an emergency clause. This would take effect on July 1st, 2005. You also have a sunset. The task force would go away upon convening of the next regular biennial legislative session.
All right. So there's two does two things. One is continuation of this program as the funds are available. The second, it does create the task force to look into this Jobs Plus program during the interim, whether it's going to be continued or discontinued. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken, does this do away with, or does it keep the language that does away with the requirement to fill only new jobs?
It eliminates it.
It eliminates that language?
That's three?
Page, yeah. You can just take page 2 through 5 out of your other bill.
So it keeps that.
It keeps that requirement. Is that right?
Mm-mm.
Mr. Chairman, it looks to me like this is a complete gut and stuff.
Complete. Okay.
It shows.
And trying to come on over. Could you explain to us? Yes.
Tamarin.
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. And the dash three amendments that you have in front of you, I received a request from Representative Lynn to help a legislative council in crafting language that would allow the Jobs Plus program to continue with monies left at the end of this biennium and through next biennium, and create a task force to study a continued use of a diversion at another point for a Jobs Plus program or other workforce training programs. So that's what this, I believe this draft does, and I can answer specific questions if you have some specific questions.
Vice Chair Merkley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Could you give us a sense of the amount of monies that are left unobligated in the Oregon Jobs Plus Wage Fund, whether those would continue to be supplemented under this bill, or whether they would be drawn down, and would they be drawn down, keeping the program at its current size, how quickly would they be drawn down?
The answer to that question is, at this point, given our budgeting process, we believe that there will be $2.4 million worth of money left in the fund, of which $600,000 will probably be obligated. So that would leave $1.8 million of unobligated funds that we'd be able to expend through the next biennium. That would require, and we are also, as you can see in this draft, we are limiting it to counties that have a designation of severely distressed. And so we wouldn't be running it in all 36 counties within the state of Oregon. It would still be a scaled-down program. We currently run on about $6 million a year. So this would scale down the program for the next biennium until a decision is made as to whether or not to reauthorize another diversion to continue the program forward in the same fashion,
yes,
or another fashion, or to create a different program altogether.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So the distressed area that the OECD will decide which is the distressed area according to this one.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. They have a process by which they utilize to designate counties as distressed. I beg your forgiveness. I forgot to bring the most current map that we have. I think that you did get a map from Economic and Community Development today. But, yes, they do basically designate the distressed counties based on a whole number of factors, and it would be within those counties that this program would continue to be delivered.
Right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. How would this impact the issue regarding the tax rates that we discussed on Wednesday?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, because there's not we're not asking for any additional monies to be going into the Jobs Plus Fund, we're not asking for a diversion in this version of the amendments, there will be more money coming out of the trust fund, so there's no effect on the tax rates with this version.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the department have a position on this amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley, I believe we could say that we would be happy to staff the task force and look at the idea. The Jobs Plus Division is not the only diversion that people have been coming to the department to ask about. We've had several requests for diversions of unemployment insurance trust funds this legislative session for possible legislative proposals in the future. So I would say that we would feel very happy with being able to conduct a study and look at the use of monies, and I believe that the governor's office would be supportive of this as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And is it possible the cost to run this program is one-third of the total amount? Is that possible? Can you streamline it and reduce the administrative cost on this?
Mr. Chair, I'm probably not the most appropriate person to comment about the administrative costs, because those are fairly fixed costs with respect to the amount of money that we spend on actually creating jobs for this program and placing people in there. Is there room for streamlining? I can't argue that there wouldn't be, but I can't give you specifics on how it could be streamlined without having somebody that actually delivers the program answering some of those questions.
All right. Thank you very much.
One more question.
Yes. Representative Dallin.
When you have a person apply to the department for a benefit, they can either take the benefit, look for an extension, or rent it out. If they apply for Jobs Plus, is that a savings, a cost, or just how does that impact the trust fund? Which way runs the cheapest, with Jobs Plus or with fully utilizing benefits as they become available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallin, I think there's a legitimate question as to whether the data between what the Employment Department has and the data that the proponents of the bill have with respect to whether it results in savings. The Employment Department honestly believes that the Jobs Plus program costs money. The proponents believe that it saves money. I can't give you a definitive answer. We have some spreadsheets that we've looked at, had the program running over the last 4 years, and the actual costs to the department, we believe it costs money, because you're actually diverting that money away from the trust fund and using the administrative money from that amount as well, in which we get administrative money for other for the purposes of unemployment insurance from a completely separate fund that doesn't touch the trust fund. I think there are legitimate questions as to whether or not it results in savings or not to put people in the Jobs Plus program, and that's why we would be happy to look at actually studying the data to make sure that if we are costing money, we don't continue to cost money, or if we're saving money, we continue the program and fix it and to save even more money.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It is unfortunate that we don't have enough information at this point whether this will save tax dollars or spend tax dollars more than it should. And so that the department should have that information available for us. Without knowing it, we are just moving along without having any compass in the ocean.
Mr. Chair, I have been working with the director who put together a spreadsheet recently and is having some people look over the actual figures that I'd be happy to make sure that you get that show that in our analysis of the program actually cost money. As it's actually implemented.
All right. If any questions? If not, then thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, that was the -3 amendment. In front of us, we have also the -2 amendment. And then let us look it up and try to compare what it is. And before we compare ourselves, I'd like to call the Mark King. Would you please come forward, please? Okay, Mark, do you have anyone else like to come?
Mr. Courtney's here with me as well, as we was the other day.
All right, please come.
is John Courtney. I work with Higher Calling Public Affairs.
And hold on 1 second. This is a very important moment at this time of this waning hours of the legislative session. Especially this might be the last public hearing for the House bill of this Trade and Economic Committee. And it is up to you to convince the members of this committee that the dash 2 is a better choice than dash 3. And in about the 30 minutes or so, we might have to make a final decision on this issue. So I'm sure you know that, but I just want to make sure we understand each other on that point. Thank you.
Thank you,
Chairman. Who's going to start first?
Chairman, members, I'll begin first if I could. You have in front of you answers to some of the questions that you had asked when we held your hearing on Tuesday and we testified. I thought I'd write out the answers and be very specific. But let me start by saying I think that the Dash 3 amendments, just very succinctly and give you an overview, I think the Dash 3 amendments will create a great study committee. I'm not sure about the membership. I have not seen the Dash 3 amendments before just now. I can tell you that 4 years ago when this program was reauthorized, we worked very closely with the department, and our plan was to study the data completely. We had quite a few data fields that we were going to prepare for this session. For one reason or another, that did not happen. And we have a discussion coming up at 11 o'clock this morning with the department to go through a spreadsheet that you have in front of me. I can tell you in the 10 years this program has operated statewide, I have not once seen a spreadsheet with this level of detail from the department analyzing these costs. We've prepared this on our own. We've asked for data over the years, and we've put this together, and this is our best estimate of it. Many of the numbers come directly from the department. Some of them were our best guesses. So I'll take
you. The last 10 years, are you talking about the total Jobs Plus program? Are you particularly talking about this the 3307? 3307 started that the 2001 was it? When this one started?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the current form of the unemployment insurance,
yes,
part of the Jobs Plus program was reauthorized in 2001. The only change that was made to it, there were two changes. One, the subsidy was brought down from minimum wage subsidy to $5 an hour. It was felt that unemployment insurance claimants have more experience and therefore the subsidy need not be as high. And the duration of the subsidy was moved from 6 months to 3 months for the same reason. Those are the only changes. Essentially exactly the same program. Works in the same way.
All right. Thank you.
So I guess all that is to say, and I'll give you a concluding remark to start with, because I think it's the focal point. If this program needs to be stopped at this point, there will be a lot of difficulty in ramping it back up, because employers count on it, they look to it, they're aware of the program. When they hear a program dies, then they walk away, and it's very hard to get them engaged again. As you might know, the department tries to partner with employers across the state, and those partnerships are hard to develop for one reason or another. But I can also tell you that in our estimations, and I'll take you through the spreadsheet, this will increase employer taxes. It may hit the trigger point by taking it away because of the savings the program's had over the past 4 years and is projected to have in the future, and it will eliminate jobs. So I'll take you through the sheet here if you would like, starting with the question of will Jobs Plus affect unemployment taxes. Number one, Jobs Plus lowers unemployment taxes. It's very important to understand. Program reduces the need to claim benefits from the UI Trust Fund because it spends less than it saves. In the past two biennia, Jobs Plus directly saved $20.9 million to the UI Trust Fund. You'll see the spreadsheet here, avoiding a current increase in tax schedules. We would be at the trigger point, given the legislation that's passing through right now, without having Jobs Plus over the past biennies. So, you turn to the color.
So, what you are saying to actually contradict with the assertion from the employment department. Chairman, you are saying this cost money, and you are saying you are saving about the $21 million.
Mr. Chairman, as the committee, yes, that's true.
Right.
We've been looking at essentially one side of the equation, and that's the administrative costs, which we focused on as a third of the costs, and then another two-thirds cost that goes to the reimbursement. Totally ignored what the cost savings are here and what money we would spend on each one of these claimants to serve them otherwise. So that's a fantastic opportunity, and it's important to understand these numbers. If you look at the colored sheet, you can see two columns. The first column is a UI claim with no Jobs Plus. The next column shows what happens with Jobs Plus and what the expenditures are. The third column shows the direct savings. And I say direct savings because there are indirect savings to this program that are as large or larger than the direct savings. But I won't take you through those today unless you'd like to hear about them. For a UI claim with no Jobs Plus, you can see that we know that 40,000 people have exhausted their claims who are not all claimants, but these are claimants who are unattached. These are claimants who are trying to work within the state. These are people that don't have a job to go back to with an employer, and they don't have the union helping them trying to find a job. This is the class of people that the department is charged with helping and that we're all here to try to help. Over 40,000 of them in the past 2 years have fallen off the end. They've exhausted. They've gone 6 to 9 months. More than 10,000 have gone beyond 9 months. So as you drop down, you can see that the benefits paid to these people have been $7,800. The administration spent for these people trying to help them back to jobs has been $252. The total cost per participant without Jobs Plus that we're spending currently, $8,052. Move over to the next column, and you can see the benefits paid before Jobs Plus to those that were putting in. In 2001, the numbers we received from the department at that time were 8.14 weeks, was before the number of weeks before they were placed in a job. That's actually 9.14 weeks after they made their claim. A little over 2 months is when we placed them. For those who did not receive a job through Jobs Plus, which has become a smaller percentage, by the way, have come back on a claim, and the numbers we had from the department is they come back on an average of 5.2 weeks for a cost here of $208. The Jobs Plus subsidy line, you can see, is $2,080. That's what goes to employers to encourage them to train these people. It's leveraging employers' goodwill and willingness to take a chance on someone. The administration, we were told it was $666. I've recently heard from the department that that's gone up more in their estimates. We're estimating $700 here to be conservative. Total $4,616. So you can see what we have been spending on all those who were not eligible for Jobs Plus, or who were eligible for Jobs Plus but did not receive it because we carved the program back 4 years ago. We spent about $8,000 on them. Same population, same pool. In Jobs Plus, we spent $4,616 on them. The direct savings, $3,436 per person. If you multiply it out just by the 3.5 years of the numbers that we have from placements for those two biennia, 6,088 people were placed in these jobs and received training. When you multiply it out, you can see that we would have spent $49 million on these people. That's how much. We actually spent $28 million on these people. The net savings, $20.9 million. That goes directly to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. That, of course, is the fund that triggers the tax. And you can drop down one more line, and you can see the return on the investment. When we spend $28 million on Jobs Plus, we get back more than we spend by $20 million. That's a return on investment of 74% in the past two biennia. I'm going back to the questions answered sheet and the bullet points here. In the next 8 years, we estimate the program will directly save $26.9 million to the UI Trust Fund. In other words, if you take it away, that's the money that you'll have to raise taxes by for employers. That, I'm told, would hit a trigger point and raise us to a higher tax schedule. Jobs Plus is targeted to serve people who are likely to be unemployed 6 to 9 months, and its cost $4,600. I've taken you through that and what these people are costing otherwise for us to help. Claimants entering Jobs Plus no longer need to draw the benefits from the trust fund, so you can see just a few notes on how that all works here below. I'll drop down to question two unless you have some questions right now. Point number two, will the Jobs Plus diversion trigger a rate schedule change? I think I've just taken you through that as well. The diversion amount over 8 years, was a question yesterday. Just to clarify again, we're looking at one side of the equation. The diversion was stated as $106 million by the department yesterday. The direct claims cost saved will be a total of $132.7 million. Net savings, again, $26.7 million. I know that the reaction is normally to think about a program that's helping people and making an investment in people and showing the results of bringing them back to the wage they were at before they made a claim, getting them jobs, having high retention rates. I know the reaction is to think, well, that must cost a lot of money. How much does it cost? And I know it seems odd that it would save money. But it does. These are the numbers. Number four, Representative Merkley, you asked a question yesterday about people who have just graduated from school and whether they're eligible for Jobs Plus, and what are we doing for people who aren't within the definition of eligible for Jobs Plus? No, they aren't eligible unless they're on an unemployment insurance claim, unless we've committed that expenditure for them. There is another program under the Federal Workforce Investment Act. It is a similar program. It has a limited amount of funding and a number of struggles with paperwork, but it's called on-the-job training. You may be familiar with it. It's operated under JTPA and CDA and all prior versions of that training program, and it allows up to 50% of the person's prior wage to be subsidized to the employer for up to 6 months. And that's available in, of course, every state in the nation. It's limited in. We think it's a good complement to Jobs Plus for those who have not worked long enough to be eligible for unemployment insurance or don't find themselves claiming welfare benefits. The next page, number five, do all employers subsidize the participating employers? Representative Riley, you asked that question yesterday. That was a very good one. Actually, participating employers who participate in this Jobs Plus program, when you consider what they do and the impact on the costs, they actually subsidize all other employers. So the portion who actually commit to train a person and help them come off the unemployment insurance claim that they're on actually subsidize everyone else, because you see, they save the money to the unemployment insurance trust fund when that person comes off, and so they essentially subsidize everyone else. Sorry. Dropping down to administrative costs. Representative Lynn, you asked a question about that. The administrative costs of the program appear to have increased by 50% from $444 to approximately $700 in the past 4 years. When we spoke about this on Tuesday, I mentioned that the 50% increase had come at a time when placements had been cut by approximately one-third. Just reviewing economies of scale, maybe the cost, we think that is quite possible. This will be an area to study with the department going forward. Fixing the economies of scale appears to be quite achievable, though, from a number of perspectives, and I'll just give you a few data points to suggest opportunities. Currently, one of three job openings for Jobs Plus positions listed with the state is going unfilled. The department testified on Tuesday that the rate is more like 60% going unfilled. So, these are jobs where we're saving money, but we're not able to fill all the jobs. Although we know there are 40,000 claimants in the state who are looking for these jobs, who are eligible for these jobs, who would succeed just like all the others we put in these jobs and give them that opportunity.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question on that?
Yes.
Do you have any sort of idea of why that is, why that would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley, one of the indicators that we've seen through a study of procedures within the department is something we tried to correct 4 years ago. And it was, when you study workforce services, you might know that people's chance of getting a job and getting in the door with an employer is much better early on in their spell of unemployment. That's when they have a really good chance. Employers look in the employment gaps and other things. People become discouraged. There are a number of factors that play into it. But if you look at the data, the percent of people and their likelihood of getting a job just drops as they go out. And so one of the procedures we looked at was to see how earlier, once we identify these people, which by federal law we do, in every state in the nation, we assess and give a score statistically for every person that walks in the door within the first couple of weeks, are they likely to go to full exhaustion or not? We have a pretty good modeling. We kind of spend a lot of time on it. And we know then essentially right away who is in trouble and who we should focus our efforts on. In fact, every state has money that they target just for those people administratively. In this program, we're not doing that for one reason or another. There is no focus on doing it at one point or another within the department from what we've seen. The replacements being made at 24 weeks out, 20 weeks out, 18 weeks out. I was told in the past the average was anywhere between 8 weeks and 11 weeks average time replacement. So I don't know that we're... It may be a matter of training or just awareness of what the statistics are, that if we focus earlier with these people, we can help them more and have a better chance of doing that.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up?
A follow-up.
Given that information, do you think then the Dash 3 proposal that would allow for a studying of procedures and a revamping of the program to bring that number down from one-third or 60% or where that number is would be advantageous?
Chairman, Representative Buckley, I do. I do not think that the Dash 3 amendment should exclude the continuation of the program for all the reasons I've just mentioned. Mm-hmm. The trigger the tax schedule is up. It will kill a lot of jobs, and it's a very valuable program that's been successful for more than a decade here. But I do think the study is a great idea. Personally, I would enjoy any information I can get from the department. The department has been good about giving me data when they have time to give it to me. But we would love to study more details of this program and flesh it out and improve it in any way we can. So I do think that combination would be great.
What we need.
Thank you.
The next point on the administration is in fiscal year 2003, the placement per FTE ranged throughout the state from a low of 17 to a high of 321 per FTE. So per FTE, they're making 17 placements in some areas and up to 321 in other areas. So you can see that the multiple is 18 times more productive, in a sense, in one area compared to another. To me, that's an indicator that that there are opportunities for training, maybe better integration of marketing. Some areas are just, for one reason or another, doing a lot better than others. I took two, for example, just to show you that it's not necessarily a good economic region versus a bad one. Ben, for example, had 204 placements per FTE, and they had 0.45 FTEs there. Portland North had 51 per FTE, and they had 0.8 FTEs there. So they had a little bit more FTEs, more secure type position. But you can see that Bend, which is an economically less active region than Portland North, had four times as much activity and success. The people on the ground, the staff, have been just outstanding. They have really the right heart to help people, and they're doing a very effective job. It may be some of the tools, we just haven't found the right combination. But there's a wide variation, and what I'm suggesting here is that improvement, if it all came up to even the average in the state, we'd be making all these placements, and administrative costs would go down per placement. I think we could be placing twice as many quite easily with the same number of staff if we were helping them in ways that we could. And the study would yield that. We haven't taken the time to study that, and the department has limited time as well.
What?
So, the types of jobs Representative Merkley had asked about. I'm sorry, I skipped one. The alternatives to Jobs Plus, Representative Green, you asked a question about that on Tuesday. The state offers a variety of programs to meet the needs of these employees. They were listed by the Employment Department as the website. It's a job matching. There's case management. We have government training you're probably familiar with through the one-stops throughout the state, and every state does. The money's limited. The return on investment is limited as well. And those can be solutions for a wide variety of this, but the facts are, as much as we try, and as hard as we try, and we commit a lot more effort to it than many states, from a funding standpoint and staff standpoint as well. Despite that, in 2002 and 2003, over 40,000 claimants, it was 58,000 in one year and 45,000 in another, are falling off the edge. 40,000 who are perfect candidates for this program, they're falling off the edge. The alternatives have not worked for them, and they haven't been sufficient to help them. But we think we've laser-focused on the people who really can be helped by this program, and we think it's a critical tool for them. We'd like to see it expand. Types of jobs, Representative Merkley, you asked a question about that. On average, unemployment insurance claimants re-enter work at a statistically significant lower wage than they came in at on a claim. We know that as an average from a 2000 study by the Employment Department. We do know from a more recent study that the Jobs Plus jobs pay on average approximately the claimant's prior wage. There's a slight drop apparently after 1 year out, but it's very statistically very close. So the types of jobs may be similar to what they used to be before, but it's not a drop, and that's what everybody else experienced. That's what the people who are not the hardest people to serve are experiencing. The people who have the best chance are having a drop in their wages. The people who have the worst chance are going into this program, and they're doing as well as they did before. We think that's remarkable. We didn't expect it would do that well. There's a question about auditing employers. The staff of the Employment Department are involved in all placements. And you can see we've made a commitment. It's a part of the administrative cost of this program is to guard it and make sure that it's not abused by any employers. The law is written very carefully to give the department full discretion to penalize employers, to stop an employer from participating in the program if there's abuse. And they guard that very carefully in the field. I've spoken to a number of the staff managers in the field, and they've told me personally, but I've also heard it 4 years ago when last time it was addressed and came up in a discussion, that there are very, very few cases of abuse in the field. That was what they were seeing. And when there was a case, the tools they had to penalize employers were more than adequate. That's what I was hearing from the department. I think that's still true. Number 10, staffing companies. There were a number of questions asked about staffing companies. The Jobs Plus law was designed, you may have heard this before from the start, to require that staffing companies pass through any subsidies for Jobs Plus to the on-site employer that is their client. So they act as a conduit, an agent, if you will, for the Employment Department in helping make those placements. Indeed, across the nation, state agencies are trying to partner with employers. Employers have jobs. It makes sense. They've made a lot of partnerships. Staffing companies in particular have been very willing and good partners across the nation and here in Oregon to make more placements and help move things along in the job market. In Oregon, there's Representative Merkel, I think you asked about the temporary nature of jobs. I heard some of the numbers this morning. I think the number was that 70% of the placements into a staffing company made to their clients result in a full-time job. The industry has changed quite a bit. It used to be a more temporary short-term opportunity, then move on to another short-term opportunity and so on. For a number of reasons in the economy today, companies are using staffing companies to make a short-term test out and see if there's a fit for the employee. And the result is that 70% of them that are going through staffing companies here in Oregon in 2003 were being placed long-term, hired on at the end of that period. So I know there's been a change in the industry over the past couple of decades, and I know there's not a lot of awareness. So I appreciate that question. Mr. Chair?
Buckley.
Thank you very much. Just two quick points. If you do have a report of that kind that you can pass on to us, I'd appreciate that. And how do the staffing companies make their money? And they get money back from the employer for offering this service, correct?
Yes, they do. They do. And it's based on how long the employee stays with the employer. And so if there's a termination of that placement early on, the fee stops at that point.
And so it's within the incentive for the staffing company to try to keep the person placed right through the end because of customer satisfaction and repeat and financial incentive as well. Often what happens is if an employee doesn't work out for an employer, the staffing company will go and find another employee at their own cost who might fit better. But they're very focused on the fact that they have the same interest in long-term employment. And it's one of the reasons that the group that funds our institute and Higher Calling Public Affairs was interested in getting into the staffing industry. We have some ideas about how to lead that industry in an even stronger direction to aim it for employment. And we are proposing in a number of states across the nation programs like this, states where we have businesses and quite a few states where we don't.
Great. Any information on that 70% number would be great.
I'll get that to you here this afternoon. I present it at Buckland, Chairman. Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Could you please wrap up your presentation?
Right. Representative Lim, committee members, I'd like to conclude with a plea to you all to keep an open mind about this program. This was passed by the citizens in 91. It's operated here statewide. After a trial period, a test period, a study period, it went statewide and has operated for a decade.
As you can see, we've studied this program
extensively. We've put a lot of our own investment into it because we believe in the program and the idea of the program. And the idea is to say, when we recognize that we're committing a certain amount of funds and efforts to help people, we should think really hard about how we're doing that and trying to come up with as creative ways as we can to really serve them. You can see from the data what's happened to these people. They've gotten jobs, they've stayed at the same wage level, their retention rate is excellent, their satisfaction rate is excellent, employer satisfaction rate is off the charts, and it saves money. We don't care about fiscal impact. The money saving is icing on the cake. But the employing people and creating jobs here in Oregon with often the highest unemployment in the nation, and that's remarkable. I know you all have people in your districts who are working with the program, and it's meant for everyone across the state. It doesn't focus on any one employer, small, large, anyone who can create a job and get an opportunity. I would urge you to pass a combination of the -2 and -3 amendments. In fact, your direction and your focus on this is greatly appreciated, and I really appreciate your time. Charging us all with studying it even more deeply and improving the program, I think, is a great suggestion. But please continue the program. There are a lot of Oregonians that count on it for all the right reasons. Thank you.
And I want you to know the members of this committee, the Speaker's office, and excused us until 10:15 from the floor time, so we got a little more time for this one. Okay, Mark, you'd like to make any comment on this?
I did distribute, Mr. Chairman, and especially for Representative Merkley's benefit, a response to your questions from the earlier session, and I don't think I'm going to review it. You have it in front of you, and I believe it's adequate. Other than that, I had no intention to testify except to respond with questions, but just in conclusion, I would simply say if you look at the spreadsheets that Mr. Courtney has provided to you, they, as he said, are the direct savings, and he didn't review the indirect savings. They stop at the point of placement. Beyond that, we have a person that's employed, and his wage is probably twice what he would have had on benefits. And the impact of that on the economy and that individual, their families, I testified to before, is immense and remarkable. And we talked at length before about the value of employment and personal dignity and an opportunity to raise your family. That's what's at stake here.
Right. Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Okay, I'd like to call again at this time Tamara.
Thank you, Chairman, committee members.
Thank you.
Welcome again. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, committee, again for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Employment Department. I contacted our budget and fiscal program manager, Tracy Loudon, to come over and discuss some information with you that we had planned on discussing in a meeting this morning with Mr. Courtney and Mr. Kane to discuss some of our concerns with respect to the data and assumptions being made with respect to the savings in order to kind of come together to figure out why they're using their data and when we have our data. And rather than getting into a battle about the different data, what we put together and what we were waiting to go over with Mr. Courtney this afternoon was exactly what we've handed out with you, and that actually shows the actual costs of the program to the system with respect to actual numbers regarding the number of people that actually participated in the program, the average weeks they were that would be on unemployment insurance without the program, and the average amount of time they served on the program before placement, the average benefit check amount, and these are actual numbers. So I'm going to actually ask Tracy Loudon to go over these with you if you have any specific questions.
Okay, Tracy, do you think you can wrap up your presentation in 5 minutes, hopefully?
Very quickly. Thank you. I appreciate it. Members of the committee, my name is Tracy Loudon. I'm the budget manager for the Employment Department. I think it's interesting as I watch the goings-on over here at the legislature that many times you guys have a very difficult position in front of you and looking at the data, in that you're usually giving ranges of data to look at and make decisions based upon those ranges. When we do calculations and we work with John Courtney on it, we've tended to come down to using different ranges of people served or cost for those. Many times the methodology is similar, but the ranges of people served and the savings for each one are different. What we've attempted to do here is give some realistic ranges, and so on the spreadsheet in front of you, we've got three columns I'd like you to look at. One is non-Jobs Plus claimants, which would be people that are not served by Jobs Plus, but they're just people that claim on the UI program. The third column over says Jobs Plus claimants actual numbers, and then the fourth column is Jobs Plus claimants first 8 weeks limit. Our attempt here is to look at two columns, which are actual numbers, a third column, which would be with some of the proposed amendments that would limit the amount of time that people are on unemployment insurance before their Jobs Plus claims. It does show that there is some potential savings there, not nearly as significant as what has been presented to you this morning. Using that first category, fiscal year 2002, which was July 1st to June 30 of '02, there were 1,804 people that went through the Jobs Plus program. Those who were not on Jobs Plus averaged 18.1 weeks. Those who were on Jobs Plus averaged 14.34 weeks before they went into the Jobs Plus program. We then used the average benefit check, and we came up with, for the regular program, it cost $8.6 million. For Jobs Plus, we paid $6.8 million out in unemployment insurance before they got into Jobs Plus. If you follow those two down, then after they got into Jobs Plus, we expended $3.4 million in the Jobs Plus program. So then there's a comparison of $8.6 million to both the Jobs Plus and the unemployment insurance of 10.2. So there was a loss to the system of $1.6 million. If you look at that further column then, and if you were to assume that those people in the Jobs Plus program had only claimed unemployment insurance for 8 weeks, then you would actually have seen a savings to the UI Trust Fund of $1.4 million. Okay? The following examples then go through 3 years. It shows that during some economic periods, there's savings to the program because in 2001-02, we were in the middle of a recession, and so people tended to be on unemployment insurance for a longer period of time. But if you look at the block that says 2003 and 04, during that period of time, there's a loss to the system of about $500,000. So as many times happens with economic programs, they change and shift depending upon whether you're in a recession or if you're in a good time. For those 3 years, we think that the program saved $1.1 million to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. It was during the recession. part of our concern is we are coming out of the recession, going into a period of time that is a little bit more robust economy in Oregon. One of our concerns then is that that last number, the 469,000, is what we would experience for the next 5 to 6 years until maybe another recessionary period hit. So what you have in front of you is a range of numbers based upon assumptions, which goes from a $20 million savings to a potential $500,000 loss to the trust fund. The $20 million savings is based on the concept of using maximum numbers. Everybody that you could serve, and his numbers have in excess of 6,000 people, I think, in there, 6,088 that would be served during that time period. We're looking at a fewer number that would be served. He brought up, Mr. Courtney, that different areas of the economy in Oregon might fit better for this program, and that's what we found, too. It's sometimes difficult as a state agency to deliver a program statewide so that everybody can benefit from it and then have different pockets actually perform better than others. So in conclusion, just real quickly, it is we're looking at a potential $500,000 loss each year as we go forward compared to a $20 million savings that Mr. Courtney has. Ours is based upon what we think is more reasonable numbers. Mr. Courtney's is based upon here's a potential if everything went perfect and we were able to operate this program what employment believes is outside reasonable bounds. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? And Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really a statement, I guess, trying to understand this. You know, Mr. Lawton and Tamara and Mr. Courtney, Mr. Kane, this whole discussion we've been through has been the biggest disappointment in this legislature. I do not know why we would be in battle with our employers in our state, but it does tell me that's why we have so many unemployed. Mr. Wendt, who formed this organization and established JLWIN, one of the top three corporations in our state, has built a lot of jobs. And so I just want to tell you that I think the right way to have done this would be to work together with the employers, not to take this defensive position against the employers in this state. And until we do have this task force, apparently that's not going to happen. But I think the best thing that that employment agency could do is form positive partnerships, whether it's with Mr. Wendt or Intel or Nike or, Yam Hill County Cafe. This is very disappointing to me. And the truth is, you think you have to agree that we need jobs. It was the biggest disappointment in the last legislature. We weren't going into timber. And we're still, not finding jobs for these people. So whatever the number issue is, I hate this. I spent my life doing exactly what we've just been presented, and I don't like any of it. I just think you ought to be working together to say, how can we make this go and grow for the employee, help the employers, and the statistics based on the sustainability of this program and the wages that these individuals make in this program are far superior to many of the other programs that we operate. I hope we change our attitude and make this a plus-plus for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go on, I'd like to call at this time the Steve Lanning. You've been waiting patiently a long time. I do appreciate your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome.
I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We actually testified last week before the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee. I think there was a pretty thorough hearing in that committee on this issue as well. In your last meeting, some of the issues that came up are the reasons that we're not supporting continuation of the program with diversion of the UI Trust Fund. Partly because it is a diversion of the UI Trust Fund, which really is an accounting gimmick. It's not a legal use of the trust fund under federal law, so the money has to be diverted before it goes into that fund.
The impact on the finances of the UI system has been debated this morning, and we still believe that it has a potential to increase employer taxes. Number used in your last meeting was $88.8 million in increased employer taxes. And if whatever the number is, we don't want to see employer taxes get raised because of this. And during the recession, this body extended unemployment insurance benefits four times without raising employer taxes, and we thought that was really important. As you've heard and we've watched, the track record of this program isn't the best in the world. The high administrative costs are one factor. Also, the cost per placement for a Jobs Plus person versus the Employment Department's basic programs. We've got numbers that show that per each Jobs Plus placement, it's approximately $2,600 versus the Employment Department's basic programs, which is more closer to $730 per placement. And we also don't see it that it has a very good track record for job creation. And I think that one of the classic examples that you had a couple of days ago before this committee was that when a circus came to Oregon, those jobs would have been created anyway, setting up the circus, and that was just one example. So it's for all the reasons that you've heard and that you're now considering the Dash 3s that we don't support this program. And it certainly is important to take a good close look at it on whatever numbers are out there, whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, before you move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. Vice Chair Mokley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lane. Just to clarify, most of your comments were aimed at the Dash 2, but your closing comment I missed. Did you say the Dash 3 is workable for you, or do you oppose it also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, we would not oppose the Dash 3s using the money that's already in the system and in the program. I think it's $1.8 million or whatever it is, and a task force. I think that after we've had this program for a decade, it certainly is called for having a task force.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And I'd like to recognize that I'm not calling you back, but that I just want to recognize that Ted Abram is in the audience. He's a good friend of mine. He is the instrumental bringing 1993 the Oregon's TANF program, work program, that has been working in the last 15 years. And according to the claims that we have been saving about $150 million a year with that program. So this is unemployment tax program. This is a part of that the mega program. Okay, I'd like to have a recess about 5 minutes before we have a work session on this one. Do we have a motion to adopt out of these two amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Vice Chair Mokley?
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 3307.
Okay. The Vice Chair Mokley moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendment to the House Bill 3307. Please call the roll.
Representative Dallin?
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
Aye.
Representative
Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Chair Lim.
No.
That's the lone vote. Okay. Dash 3. The Dash 3 adopted. All right. That's my amendment, but I want to give them a vote of support. The reason why I'm voting no on Dash 3, even though I initiated this bill, at least I want to give moral support of the Dash 2 amendment. That's the only reason. Otherwise, I support the Dash 3. Right? So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In that case, I would like to also then say, being the author of the Dash 1 that's included in the Dash 2, I support it, but I'd do anything to move ahead finding jobs for people, and I know this program should be doing a far better job than is being done in our employment agency.
Yes, but you can count on me on the floor. I will be supporting the studio amendment. And then do we have a motion to pass this House Bill 3307 then? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3307 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Do you go to the floor or do you go for the floor?
Mr. Chairman,
already funded.
This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. You could substitute the Budget Committee for that. We don't have permission to send it directly to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I amend my motion to move it to that House Budget Committee, where I hope it doesn't stay forever.
Okay. Since this is a current program, do we need to send to the Budget or Ways and Means?
My understanding on it in the dash threes, the money that's currently in that program is not currently appropriated. There's no vehicle for appropriating that. This would be the vehicle for that, and that would be done by the Budget Committee.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
I understood the money was appropriated. The only expense that isn't covered is that of the task force for those that would get paid.
Can you come and clarify the things we are discussing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman, Legislative Coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. Because the question with respect to the $1.8 million that would be left, is my understanding that we will need an expenditure limitation from the Budget Committee in order to spend that money because there was not an additional funding mechanism planned and assumed. We didn't ask for the additional money to be spent because we thought the program was going away. So we will need an expenditure limitation in the Budget Committee to spend the money.
Thank you for your wisdom. Appreciate it. Okay, with that, then your motion to amend it to send to the
Budget Committee.
Budget Committee. Okay. Any discussion? And please call the roll.
Representative Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative
Buckley.
Aye.
Representative
Ballant.
Aye.
Carolyn.
Aye.
The House Bill 3307 with amendment is passed to the Budget Committee. With that, Ms. Biasano, for the business, meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.